Blog Talk Radio.
Ken Hudnall, this is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. You know, I've lived in this town for, well over 20 years. You know, growing up, you always heard about the heroes of Texas, among which were the Texas Rangers. Supposedly, when a crime was committed, they were there. Well, today I got an education. I've made no secret of the fact that we put a roof on this house. The roofers totally screwed it up, walked off, left it. It failed inspection. They didn't care. The local ordinance, which is based on the local government code, which is state law, said they had to post insurance for the protection of the citizens. Well, according to the roofers, yeah, they had to post it, but they didn't have to use it. City says, eh. So I turned the matter over to the Texas Rangers. I pointed out there was fraud committed, number of other things. And there's a local office of the Texas Rangers, and I talked to their lieutenant. Oh, yeah, we're just going to jump right on it. We're going to look into this. Not a problem. Well, one, since there was fraud involved, the ranger turned it over to the fraud division of the Department of Public Service. And, you know, golly gee whiz, you know, they're not attorneys. They're going to give it back to the Rangers. And I talked to the ranger that we're going to give it to, and he said, well, we're coming up on holidays, and, you know, golly gee whiz, yeah, you know, you may be seriously damaged, and you got all these medical problems caused by the mold that has come into the house, but, you know, my vacation's coming up, and that's more important. So I talked to the ranger lieutenant today, and he was just all over me. You called 16 times. Did you return any of the calls? Maybe I would have stopped if you'd have returned the call and talked to me. Well, we got more important things to do. You're not the most important person in the country. No, but I am a Texas citizen who has brought a problem to the Texas Rangers that involves the violation of state law. Now, as I've said to a number of folks, if you don't want to do the job that you have taken on, quit. There's plenty of other people who want to step into your shoes. But what did I know about the law? Well, I got a bachelor's and a master's in criminal justice and got a law degree. And until I met some crooked judges, I was happily practicing law. Well, I just didn't understand them, what they were doing. I said, well, maybe I don't, but I understand that I've come to you and asked for help and pointed out the laws were broken, and you don't care. Oh, well, we care. Then why don't you do something? Just a phone call would be wonderful, but you're too busy strutting around with your badge made out of silver dollars and your pistols on your hips and your Stetsons and letting everybody notice how important you are. Well, if you don't do your job, all the strutting in the world isn't going to make up for it. Now, you see all these TV shows like Walker, Texas Ranger. He was a man that stood up. I can't find any rangers that want to stand up. All they want to do is attack the people who come to them for help. Well, it seems in Texas, if you know the right people and you grease the right palms and you take the right people to lunch, the laws don't apply to you, especially in El Paso. I talked to the Attorney General's office. Well, we can't come in and do anything unless the district attorney invites us. I could tell you stories about that district attorney. So I used to work for a man who enjoyed letting us know how important he was. That, you know, he slipped a little money to the DA and he slipped money to this one and slipped money to that one. What happened to justice? Texas is supposed to be a state where justice is first and foremost. I can't even get the local legislator to return a phone call. I guess that explains how things have descended to the level they're at in Washington. Everybody's concerned about their own pockets. And what they don't seem to understand is people tell me things. I find out things. And I write books and I write stories. Well, I could tell you about this current governor and some of the shenanigans he's pulled. I can tell you about roofers who want to take advantage of disabled veterans. See, according to the average individual, veterans get all this free money, and they're entitled to some of it. But nobody cares, because then they might have to do their job, or they might make somebody angry, and golly gee, they wouldn't want to do that. Well, if you want to call in, number's 267-521-0159. One night I'm going to sit down and start telling you all the stories of some of the important people I have dealt with. How about a senior senator who orchestrated a cover-up, who took a bribe? I've got the documents to prove it. Well, we're going to turn our attention back to our normal topic of discussion, which is the strange and the unusual. Though I would say that Schiff and his bunch certainly fall into that category. Well, in the Manchic Swamp of Louisiana, now that's an interesting area. It's an unincorporated community in Tangipahoa Parish in Louisiana. They have parishes instead of counties. And in that parish, not only does the legend of the Rougarou still resound, for those that are not familiar with that term, that is the Cajun werewolf. But there's also the legend of Julia White. Now, it's a legend, but it's also based on a true event. She was a voodoo queen, and there's a connection between her death and the destruction of a number of small communities in that parish. Now, she lived in that parish for many decades, and this was in the early 1900s. And as people came to know about the fact that she was a voodoo priestess, and the belief in voodoo, in fact, is still strong today. But she lived in the early 1900s, and as her powers became known, those who lived in the area would go to her house wanting her help with healing or love spells or something like that. And she would help anybody who came to her. She did powerful voodoo, conjuring to some of the supernatural power to bring forth her client's request. But it was said that her powers in the occult area were so great that the very people who wanted her help began to regard her with suspicion and fear. Because if she could help them, if she chose to do so, she could hurt them. Well, as she grew older, it was almost as though the local folks' superstitions toward her grew stronger, and it was, frankly, only when they needed something and they came to see her. In the meantime, they made sure to keep their distance from her house, and as a result, she was even more isolated. But although she always kept to herself, as time went on, she found herself constantly alone. Until somebody had a problem and turned up on her doorstep and begged her to help. Now, there's not a single story or even a rumor that she ever used her powers to do harm to anybody, but it was believed she could if she wanted to. It was almost as though the locals felt she might put the evil eye on them if they got friendly with her. So they all kept their distance, unless they needed something. Well, the longer she lived alone and isolated, and the longer people avoided her, the more eccentric she seemed to become. When local people did pass her house, they began to hear her singing. And apparently she did have a worthy singing voice, but she sang the same refrain over and over again. It wasn't the sound of her singing that disturbed people. It was what she was singing. She would sing the same little ditty, "On the day I die, I'll take you all with me." And she sang that over and over and over. Well, add this to the fact she always appeared to be able to predict when something bad was going to happen. So folks started to get worried. She could see misfortune coming, and she wasn't afraid to say so. And it scared the local folks who, you know, weren't the most sophisticated to begin with. And they all hoped and prayed she wouldn't predict that harm would come to them. But she was always correct when she made her dire predictions, and the locals wondered whether this power prediction truly came from. They began to believe it could be coming from evil spirits or maybe the devil himself. They all believed, as a voodoo priestess, she had a direct line to the devil. Well, her old house sat on the edge of the swamp, and she would sing that same song every day. And finally, people seemed to think they could hear it coming from all directions. "On the day I die, I'll take you all with me." And then that day came, she died. And on the day of her funeral, just as her body was being laid to rest in the burial plot, one of her terrible predictions came true. The very words in the song she had sung every day that put such fear into the neighborhood turned into reality. She had said for years, when her death came, she'd take the entire town with her. Everybody would die. Well, just as they were lowering her body into her grave, a hurricane tore through the region, tearing everything up and killing multiple people as it came. Came out of nowhere. No predictions, no warning, just here it came. In fact, more than one town was destroyed that day. And the hurricane devastated many of the residences and businesses in nearby towns as well. It claimed the lives of more than 100 people. And when the worst had passed and a handful of survivors remained, they came back to finish her burial and the coffin had vanished. Right out of the grave. Now, they hadn't covered the grave up yet when the storm hit. Well, it wasn't until the water levels went down and the weather became calm again that her body was found deep inside the Manchik Swamp. Her house had been destroyed as well. And as for many who died that day, they were all buried together in a huge mass grave in the swamp. And with so many bodies buried inside that swamp, superstition and fear of the swamp only increased. And those who went into the swamp were warned that even though more than 100 people had been buried in there, it was also the final resting place of the Voodoo Queen, who many believed had caused the hurricane to come and kill those buried in the mass grave. In Louisiana, of course, there's also the legend of the Loup Garou, who said to lurk within the swamps of Louisiana. The Loup Garou, or the Ron Garou, is a creature of myth and legend who's used as the epitome of a scary monster to keep the Cajun children in line. If they didn't mind their P's and Q's, the Loup Garou would come and snatch them away and take them into the swamp. He was believed to live in a swamp, and its food were the children. Or so the old folks in Louisiana would tell their kids. Now, this half animal, half man, said to have been lurking in the Louisiana swamps for centuries. The Loup Garou is believed to be a shapeshifter akin to the werewolf. Said to have originated in Europe, inadvertently been brought to Louisiana by the early settlers. Creature was first recorded in the Kamouraska on the south shore of the St. Lawrence River in the vast St. Lawrence region of Quebec, Canada. But a lot of the Cajuns came to Louisiana from Canada. From the Annals of the Quebec Gazette, 1776, comes the following report. By accounts from St. Rock, we learn there's a werewolf wandering about the neighborhood who, to the talent of persuading people to believe what he is ignorant of and promising what he can't perform, adds an obtaining of what he desires. Said this animal came by the assistance of his two hind legs to Quebec on the 17th of last month with a design to pursue his errand. The beast is said to be as dangerous as that which appeared last year in the county of Givaudan. The public was warned to be cautious. Well, there was another account, December 10th, 1767. We learned that a werewolf has roamed through this province for several years and done great destruction with several attacks in the last month by different animals. They had the army out against this monster, and in November, animals received such fierce attacks that it was thought they were entirely delivered from this fatal animal, who then sometimes after retired to its hole. The beast wasn't destroyed. It begins again to show itself, more furious than ever, and wreaks havoc wherever it goes. Well, before these sightings, in Europe in the Middle Ages, just as with witches and warlocks, suspected werewolves were made to stand trial as well. often facing torture until they confessed to their evil sins, most notably to the accusations that sold their souls to the devil in exchange for the gifts of wolf power. They'd have all manner of torture instruments used on them, and once they confessed, they'd be burned at the stake. Now, werewolf trials were common throughout the Middle Ages into the early modern period. Along with accusations against witches in Switzerland, werewolf trials began in the Valais and Vaud regions, and it spread to many European countries, including Bavaria, Austria, Carinthia, from the 16th to the 18th centuries. Interestingly, at the same time, there are even accusations by the authorities of people being wolf riders or wolf charmers. In Vaud, Switzerland, prior to the more well-known Inquisition, a witch hunt on a grand scale took place. Witches and werewolves, accusations are interlinked with the belief that they were inseparable supernatural activities. More than 300 probably innocent people were put on to death based on allegations they were either witches or werewolves. Now, reading some of the methods of determining if someone was in line with the devil is interesting. If you were thrown into, if you were accused of being a witch, you were thrown into a lake or river. If you sank and drowned, you were innocent. If you knew how to swim or managed to get to the shore, that proved you were in line with the devil and you were executed. Kind of a no-win situation. According to the man known as Peter, the chief inquisitor, described in Thomas Wright's Narratives of Sorcery and Magic, written in 1852, many witches and sorcerers confessed to all kinds of terrible activities. They made people's secrets known, caused people to be struck by lightning or disease. Being of both sexes, they transformed themselves into wolves or other beasts in order to devour their prey at ease. And they particularly liked to target children. They lay in wait, watching for opportunities to push them into rivers or any other means of causing them to have accidents, so it would appear they died naturally. If possible, they killed them before baptism. When buried, they dug the bodies out of the graves and carried them off to for their secret rites. They boiled them in cauldrons and reduced them to liquor. In Austria, werewolf and witch trials were held in an 800-year-old castle called Mushum Castle, also known as the Witch Castle, because of the trials that were held there. 1715, deer and cattle were discovered slaughtered by an unidentifiable animal, and the werewolves were suspected to be the culprits behind these killings. When first beggars were rounded up and taken to the castle, they were held in a dungeon and subjected to the most brutal torture using a range of barbaric instruments, with the intention of getting them to confess to their sorcery and shape-shifting into werewolves. Well, let me ask you a question. If you had that ability, wouldn't you use it for profit and not be a beggar? Well, not in the minds of the simple folk. After torture, though, the beggars confessed and said they'd been given a dark-colored ointment from the devil himself. And this ointment had special abilities that would transform into ferocious werewolves once they applied it to their bodies. Once they had transformed, they'd roam the countryside, attack cows or sheep, mutilating and eating them. Well, once they confessed, they were tortured to death or burned at the stake. More than 130 people were accused of being shape-shifting werewolves or sorcerers, and the range of punishments included beheadings and hangings. Now, the vast majority of those accused were males. Now, the castle is a family home today, and it's a major tourist attraction thought to be haunted by the souls that are tortured who died there. And some of the torture implements used on the victims remain on display. Well, in a much more recent account, Eric Martin and his wife, Shelley Rockwell Martin, perhaps have had the most well-known encounter with a werewolf, or frankly, an entire pack of them. It happened, according to them, in 2007, in the small rural town of Palmyra in the Somerset County of Maine. They just moved to the property where Shelley would be looking after her husband following an industrial injury that had ended his career. They bought an old but picturesque farm and thought it'd be just the place to take life at a slower pace. One evening, shortly after moving into their new home, they were sitting on the porch, as they like to do in the evening. when they started to see lights appearing in the woods that surrounded the house. Well, Eric thought at first it was probably hunters with flashlights, but something made him reconsider this when the lights didn't seem to display the characteristics of somebody carrying a flashlight. We decided to walk closer to the woods to see if he could get a better look. As he approached the trees, the lights went out. Well, the silence was unnerving, and each snap of a twig underfoot could be heard clearly. He entered the woods, but could find no one there, nor any tracks that might have indicated hunters had been there. Felt fear like he'd never known before, despite being an experienced hunter himself. He said things just didn't feel right. We shook it off, though, and we returned to the porch and did his best to forget about it. A couple of nights later, their dogs wouldn't go to their outside pen. They were shaking and petrified. Now, the night was strange enough with a heavy fog, and then they heard a strange sound in the distance inside the woods. They didn't recognize the sound, but the danger it implied chilled them both. Back inside the house, hearing the sound of rustling behind them as they went, they turned around as they got to the door and saw five sets of eyes shining out behind the trees. Well, Martin didn't think this could be a group of bears. He was used to seeing animals at nighttime on hunting trips, but this just didn't feel right again. Fear permeated the air. Although they're now indoors, he wanted to get his guns to protect himself and his wife, but they were out in the shed for safekeeping. As one lady said when asked, did she have a gun to protect herself? Was it loaded? And she said, what good's an unloaded gun? That's a paperweight. What good is having a weapon if it's in a shed outside the house that you can't get to in case of danger? Well, the creature was now emerged from the woods and was standing on their hind legs staring at the house. Now, the dogs were hiding in another room in the house, cowering in fear. He attempted to go outside to get the car closer so he could get his wife and daughter into the car and get them away to safety. He believed from the size of the creatures that were standing on their hind legs and at least 7 or 8 feet tall, they could break through down the door if they chose to do so. Well, when he went outside to get the car, their security motion light came on and illuminated the creatures standing within meters of him. In fact, they surrounded him. He rushed back inside the house, abandoning the idea of getting the car completely. They called the police, and the police, of course, didn't believe him. They're about as effective as the so-called brave Texas Rangers that I'm trying to deal with. They watched from the top floor of the house all night, too afraid to go to bed. And when the morning came, the creatures were gone, but they'd stayed out there all night, scratching on the walls and doors of the house. They found huge tracks outside that showed long claws, and the tracks showed the creatures had been walking upright, not on all fours. Wolves, bears, dogmen, and they created an illusion they disguised to appear as creatures when they were really extraterrestrial or demonic interdimensional entities. And what were the strange lights that seemed to accompany them? These are the questions that this couple asked. The police, when they were brought out, didn't want to believe what they were seeing with their own eyes because these things don't happen. Back in 1972, reports also emerged from Defiance, Ohio. Reports were of a werewolf or wolfman on the loose. The accounts were centered around the railroad for some reason. Railroad workers had separate nighttime encounters with a creature that led them to, that to them could only be described as wolfman. One of the rail workers even claimed to have been attacked by the creature, which rather oddly was described by him as wearing jeans and carrying a long piece of timber, which he used to hit the rail worker from behind. Two other separate night workers described seeing a creature was upright on its back legs and walking covered in dark fur. Each sighting was in the early hours, and all said the creature, a wolfman, vanished into the woodlands surrounding the rail tracks. Store worker in his car came forward to say it had ran across the path of his car as he was driving in the early hours of the morning. Then it vanished, running at what he called high speed. Three separate individuals went to the police and told them they'd seen a large beast that appeared to look like a werewolf. Sheriff confirmed we didn't release the reports to the general public or the news media. We didn't want to upset people. When each of the three reported sightings, the descriptions given to police was, he said, vague. Each of the reports closely resembled one another, and that's significant similarities. Each witness mentioned the hairiness of the creature, and all said it looked like a wolf man, but the sheriff said he was inclined to believe it was a person wearing some disguise or a mask. Such is the brilliance of some of our elected officials. He added the witness said the creature had a lot of hair that looked natural. And although the sheriff said he felt at first it was a local person playing a joke on people, he did add that the height of the creature was described by all three witnesses as between 7 and 9 feet tall. Now, I don't care if you're playing a joke or not. If I see something 7 to 9 feet tall covered with hair coming at me, I'm going to shoot it. The first two witnesses, Tom Jones and Ted David, who worked on the railways, both said it had huge hairy feet and fangs. One of them said it ran from side to side on its back legs, and when Mr. Jones first saw it, he said, I thought it was a joke, and then I saw how woolly and hairy it was, and that was it for me. Well, after the creature disappeared, he said he quickly counted up the other workers on the night shift. None were missing, so he knew he could rule out any of his co-workers being behind it and playing a trick on him. Same time it disappeared, he said he heard a scream in the distance. Now, if you want to be involved in the discussion, I invite you to call 267-521-0159. At first, the story wasn't taken seriously by the local law enforcement, according to Sheriff Don Breckler. But he told reporters as the number of sites increased, we're taking it seriously now. We're concerned for people's safety. We don't think it's a prank anymore. Another man sought refuge in what he believed was the same thing. In the early hours of one morning, not long after the other sightings, a man went to the police station and reported something had followed him on foot along the street. While he said he didn't turn around to look at it, he could feel it getting closer, saying he had this crawling feeling going up his back. When he got to the police station, he was hysterical. Same night, a homeowner called the police for help because her friend and her were terrified. Said that for the last few nights, her back doorknob was being rattled and they were too terrified to go to bed. Another woman nearby called the police saying she was going to shoot whatever was scratching at her back door trying to get in. Well, whatever it was, after a period of time, the report stopped, but it was whatever the creature was never caught, and the feeling was it had moved to another location. But I will have to say, in my humble opinion, these police officers couldn't catch coal in a snowstorm. Well, in rural Roseberry, Oregon, a middle-aged couple runs a foster home for adult care on their own property. But problems began that made those that live there want to leave. And the couple who run it, as well as the folks who live there, are all in fear of their lives. Now, the home is surrounded by woods, but they feel they're under attack. There's a heavy, ominous atmosphere inside the home, and for its owners, it's led to illness and great concern. For the longest time, they say that something was happening to them inside the house and outside, too. There were drains of energy, feeling weak and ill, suffering terrible mood swings, on the verge of breaking up. In fact, they hated going outside. The woods that had been such a nice place now terrified them. Inside the house, they could see faces looking in the window. And there'd be terrible sounds of knocking and banging coming from areas in the house where no one was, or sounding like it was coming from outside the house, banging and knocking on the doors and walls. And they were hearing voices that belonged to no one living in the house. The owner of the house, whose name is only given as Lori, said everybody's hearing voices. Everybody's afraid to go to bed at night. Everybody's having mood swings affecting our relationships. We don't want to leave. I grew up here. But our moods change suddenly to rage. We're all getting ill. We're tired all the time, completely drained of energy. Well, they called in a psychic medium named Amy Allen. She was on a Travel Channel show called Dead Files. And the first thing she said was there was a doorway. And what she said about it was shocking. She said it's pretty long and it goes pretty far into some kind of path separate from the doorway. There are dead people walking on it. I'm very concerned about the living people wandering into it and disappearing into another dimension. And some living people have disappeared. There's a barrier. Someone's put up protection around the property, but things are still getting in. Dead people and strange creatures are getting into the home. They're scratching on the walls. What I'm seeing coming out the doorway are creature-like things, but I don't know what they are. Now, a caregiver who lives there named Julia woke up with a bite mark on her arm. Said it looked like human teeth marks. She won't go outside anywhere near the wooded area. She says she has seen lights flashing in the woods and doesn't understand why. First time it happened, went outside the next day expecting to see human tracks, but could find no trace of a human having been there. Well, the psychic went into more detail about what she saw. She said there's this path that goes very far. I think over the years, sometimes some living people have gone into this and they vanished. They've disappeared in this other dimension. She said she sees a creature thing, big and dark. It seems like a devil. She feels real fear. It looks like a creature scratching on the outside walls. She said there are a number of different entities, and some of them could be dangerous. She drew a sketch of one of the creatures she said she could see. It looked a bit like a wolf, but standing upright with very, very long legs. She said there was this weird person that ran out of here and then jumped out at me and growled and was trying to bite my chest and my throat. But they just ran away, and it was like out of nowhere. Well, the medium went outside to take a walk around the property, and she said she kept hearing the word predator over and over again. She said, I felt something bearing down on me, like something really large was behind me running at me. And then I could hear that predator. I encountered several entities during my walk, but two stood out the most. First, the creature I saw trying to get into the house, so it was kind of clinging to the house. Its limbs ended in claws and fangs. And a haunted dead man. When I came into the house, I saw a male lying on the floor, apparently dead. He was being tormented by something. Outside, most of the activity that's happening here is actually coming from two different places. The first one, it looks almost like this very long hallway. And I saw, what I saw coming out of it was these really odd mutant animals. One in particular jumps on the house. He'd bang on the house and scratch on the walls, and there's growling. He'd been doing it for a very, very long time, and he wants in. And what would happen if he got in? There would be severe problems, she said. Well, the partner of the homeowner, whose name was Devlin, said, I've come out here at nighttime, and I can just feel the presence of whatever was here. Creepy, weird things that live in those trees, and that's got me afraid. Well, the psychic explains that in the woods there is this path that goes right through here. And there are all these dead people on this path going back and forth, literally back and forth on this one path. And occasionally some of them wander off and they come through the house and they feed off negativity. They want us to fight. They want to destroy your relationship. Some of them can make physical contact, and she did see a female asleep, but there was a dead person that was actually holding her, pinning her down on the bed. She said one of them jumped out at her and he kind of ran up to her face and he was kind of aiming toward her throat and chest to try to bite her. Her biggest concern, though, is this in-between place and the fact that living people can, though rarely, but they can disappear into this parallel dimension. Well, they never discovered the how and the why of this path. But when the medium left, the problems continued. And there's another strange story that came from England. According to the person telling the story, something happened when the witness was 14. Lived in a small rural town in England. Near the house is a wood in which it's believed a father and a daughter's tombs are located. They're said to have lived in a castle that was near the woods about 300 years ago. Well, the person telling the story and some friends used to go to the woods to have smoke and get stoned and mess about. One day they were in there getting stoned when they stood on some mud. And this was a bit weird because they were having a hot summer. They kicked the mud around at each other and then spotted the bones. And without thinking, the person telling the story picked them up. And they were big and thought they had to be bones from a bull or a cow. And they decided to take them home and take them to school to show the teacher when they had the science class. So they were put into a rucksack. And when the person with the rucksack got home, put them out in the shed in the back garden and forgot all about them. A few days later, strange things started to happen in the house. They started to hear voices, whispering voices. One time they'd been out all day when the brother of the witness's friend came around the next day. She asked why they hadn't let her in. Well, the brother said they'd been out all day. She said, oh, no, I could see somebody standing in the bedroom looking out the window. Well, they all went into the brother's bedroom and nothing was out of place. They couldn't understand what had happened. About a week later, they went back to the woods to have another smoke and friend remembered about the bones. And the witness told him about what had been happening in the house, and they thought he was just stoned and joking. And he replied they wasn't joking. They found the exact spot where they'd found the bones immediately. They could see there was a huge hole in the mud. And there were more big bones. Very big bones. And that didn't make sense. Even though they presumed they'd been cow bones, there weren't any cows around. And there were no other animals that big in the woods in England. Started trying to figure out where the bones had come from and what they were. And as they turned to leave, the friend spotted a carved symbol like a strange star carved on the nearest tree. Well, as soon as they got home, they took the bones out of the shed and burned them in the back garden. And the strange things in the house started to get worse. They'd hear footsteps like somebody coming up the stairs when they're all in bed at night. Sister began to see fleeting dark shadows that were huge, and radios in the house would come on at full blast in the middle of the night. Well, it's been a good many years, and it's still happening, even though they moved out of that house years ago. Happens in his house now. Apparently, after doing some research at the library all those years ago, he discovered that the woods had a dark history being used for black magic and witchcraft. Thing was, he didn't think that symbol had been on the tree when they found the bone, so it still had to have been happening when they used smoke in the woods. Apparently, after researching online, the exact design of that symbol meant something. It meant you had really pissed off someone, and it was like a warning. Well, his last relationship ended quite quickly, just like his other ones. The girlfriend got too scared to sleep at his house. She got too scared to even be around him. So how do you make up and make peace when you disturb something like that? Well, the home of Edgar Allan Poe in Massachusetts is an area steeped in creepiness, paranormal happenings, legends, and lore. In the Cape Cod region, you have what are called the Marsh People. These entities are said not to be shadow people, but people who appear solid in mass and the color of the mud from which they emerge. They're solid forms who crawl from the mud beneath them. Well, stories of the marsh people or the swamp people go back to the 1800s when it was said they'd climb out of the marshes and drag a passing horse or a traveler down into the mud with them. Could they merely be the cause of illusions and mirages? Hunters in the swamp have had the opinion that they're more than illusions. Some reports claim people have disappeared while inside the swamp. And this could explain why the sinkholes and sinking mud are rumored to be so dangerous. These marsh people are said to have taken to the swamps when the settlers arrived, and it's now their descendants who crawl through the mud and come out to claim the odd hunter or hiker who has no idea they've wandered into terrain the swamp people considers to be theirs. Now, according to the stories, they come out of the mud hunting for human flesh, and anyone they come upon is fair game. Maybe one of the strangest true mysteries that occurred within the New England area, though, was that the odd disappearance and death of Edgar Allan Poe. This famous literary figure, whose writing was the first Gothic macabre, was himself the central figure of his own mysterious disappearance and subsequent demise. You know, there's been many stories about Poe, and it's only recently I found out how he died. See, on September 27th, 1849, Poe disappeared. He reappeared 6 days later. He was found in the street, delirious and great distress and completely incoherent. Now, he was known for being a dapper dresser, and he always had very refined clothing. And instead of his normal appearance, his clothes were filthy, scruffy, and he had dirty shoes. Neither his clothes nor his shoes fit him. It's like he had someone else's clothing. He was rushed to a medical facility where he was kept in isolation, where he lapsed into a fevered state and was barely conscious until his hasty death arrived. No one was ever able to determine what had happened to him or where he'd been in the days he'd been missing. Now, many scholars, academics, and historians have attempted to find the definitive answer to explain his unexplained disappearance and his very odd return. And while there are a number of theories, none have been proven. Now, there's mystery within mystery, such as the missing medical notes, the conflicting accounts given by friends and acquaintances, and the words Poe managed to say before he died. Now, it could be he was the victim of simple foul play. They didn't appear to have any obvious wounds when he reappeared, and where he'd been kept for days in which he'd been missing. And if he'd been kept somewhere, where would that have been? And how did he get where he was found? When he was discovered in an inn on the main street in Baltimore, an acquaintance by the name of Joseph Walker sent an urgent letter to one of Poe's friends requesting his help. He wrote to the friend, Dr. Joseph Snodgrass, an editor. He said, "The gentleman is in rather worse for wear and appears in great distress. He says he's acquainted with you and he's in need of immediate assistance." Later described Poe as wearing an expression of vacant stupidity that made him shudder. "And he'd evidently been robbed of his clothes, so stupefied we had to carry him out as if a corpse." Later he'd go on to explain that Poe was indeed terribly intoxicated, but when you look at the original letter, it doesn't appear that intoxication was the cause of the problem. And later he'd be accused of exaggerating or twisting the truth to make it appear the great writer had indeed been totally drunk instead of something much more mysterious. Now, anyone who had known the smartly and stylishly dressed Poe, the description he gave of the literary figure must have come as a complete shock. He described Poe as having vacant eyes, he was unwashed, haggard, unkempt, and repulsive. And he smelled. When Poe was taken to the nearest infirmary, the head doctor there, Dr. John Moran, for some reason confined the writer to his own room in a part of the hospital usually used for drunks. In this room, the writer was then observed to veer from unconsciousness to delirium, in which he talks aloud constantly as though to imaginary people, and he appears to see imaginary objects. And he was still unable to explain what had happened to him or where he'd been. Well, when Poe was in that room, he reportedly repeatedly called out someone's name. He called out for a person named Reynolds, yet no one could find out who this person might be. The doctor tried to find out from Poe's friends and family who Reynolds might be, but nobody knew any person by that name. When the doctor tried to reassure Poe by telling him that soon his friend would visit, the writer's response apparently was to tell the doctor the best thing Reynolds could do would be to blow his brains out with a pistol. He died in that room on October 7th. His final words, according to the doctor, were, "Lord, help my poor soul." Well, if you investigate, you'll find that there are no records of Poe's death that exist. All have been lost, if they ever did exist, or have been destroyed. His cause of death ranged from the theories of alcohol, though there's no corroboration this might have been the case. There are rumors the writer was particularly unable to hold his drink, and so the slightest imbibing of alcohol would lead to heavy intoxication. Others disputed this and said he just rarely drank. He also belonged to a temperance movement, which again would appear to contradict the theory he drank himself to death. Some wondered if he was the user of opium, but most who knew him also felt this was wholly unfounded. Others suggested he died of congestion on the brain or a brain tumor. Then they thought perhaps he had cholera or meningitis or maybe rabies, although no one would have thought perhaps the hospital he died in would have noted his symptoms if he did. The most likely scenario given is that he was found on the day of an election. He had been the victim of co-opting. This was a practice of abducting victims off the street and through force and means of threat, making them vote in multiple towns in the area while drugged to the eyebrows. People would be targeted, snatched off the street by a gang, and taken away where they'd be drugged and forced to vote for the person behind the vote rigging method. While this has perhaps become the most realistic cause of his sudden disappearance and reemergence, and one that's been mentioned in many biographies, those who disagree with the theory cite the fact he was a widely recognized figure, even if he dressed in an outfit he had never been seen wearing. His face was instantly recognizable, and it didn't seem possible he had been led to voting stations and not been recognized by officials or voters when he went in to vote. And he had no injuries that might be expected from a struggle with abductors. Others suggested he was victim of a robbery that might have left him insensible for days, but he was still carrying an expensively crafted walking stick when he was found. What perhaps is most strange is that he was not allowed any visitors when confined in the hospital. Though a cousin came to see him, officials turned him away. Details are scant, and this itself is mysterious. Despite the voluminous publication about Poe's life, the in-depth accounts of the end of his life are just not there. And the mystery of his inscrutable disappearance remains to this day. There's a lot of mysterious happenings that officials think that we, the general public, don't need to know. For our own good, of course. Of course, you have to wonder who died and made them God, but as I am discovering, there are quite a number of people who think they're the hottest thing out there. Well, it was a newlywed couple who decide to seek notoriety and reward and try to do it the easy way instead of working. So they set out on the most daring of adventures. And after it succeeded, their plan was to have been set out on a lecture tour, commanding well-earned fees for their public speaking as they regale their audience with tales of derring do. They'd become lauded celebrities, recognized among the most adventurous explorers ever known. Photographs taken just before they set off showed their fierce and fiery determination, and they looked a little bit like Bonnie and Clyde. Well on their way to conquering the world in a legal but very daring way. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out the way they anticipated. Only just newly married, this young couple chose to forego the traditional romantic honeymoon and replace it with the high-risk adventure of rafting down the rapids of the Colorado River. The wife, whose name was Betty, planned on claiming the world record as the first woman to ever make that treacherous trip, and they were going to try to beat the fastest record. November 1928, when they set out, they had fully planned their trip and adequately prepared for their requirements. They had a small flat-bottom boat used for the purpose of transporting cargo and rafting. It's about 20 feet long, weighed 2 tons, and was of the type commonly used at the time for river rafting. The husband, whose name was Glenn, had built it himself. They loaded it with the provisions they believed they'd need for the trip, which began at Hermit Rapids and set off. Well, a month later, their boat was found without a minute. Floating upright, still had the provisions in it. Didn't have any damage to it, but the newlywed couple was gone. They had simply vanished. Now, they hadn't disappeared immediately. At River Mile 231 into the journey, the boat was discovered empty. Inside the raft was Bessie's journal, which she had kept as they progressed on their journey. that last been seen on November 18th at the 165 river mile mark, and that was the last notation in her journal. Somehow after that, they both vanished into thin air. Now, prior to this, they had made sure to keep their respective families informed of their progress, and had ensured that the newspapers and photographers were charting their progress. They'd be spending almost 7 weeks in their attempt, and they wanted media coverage all the way. Well, on the day they disappeared, they actually had a schedule. They'd been making excellent progress on their journey. It was Thanksgiving, so they stopped off to celebrate with a dinner. When it was later discovered they'd gone missing at some point during after that evening, a massive search was started that made national headlines, but they didn't find a single trace of the couple. As soon as Glenn's father heard they'd disappeared from their raft, he commissioned a huge search party. Even though it was winter and in some of the roughest terrain, a massive effort was made to find him. Determined to find his son and daughter-in-law, he hired specialist researchers to go into the canyon to look for any sign they were on land. But the trackers could find no indication they left the water, and every part of that canyon was thoroughly searched in the area where they'd been known to last be, and the area where their boat turned up. Nothing that could provide any explanation. Now, this search lasted for weeks, and then it dragged into months, and the river was searched for their bodies. Now, they could have fallen in, been dragged in, but the bodies weren't found. Now, bodies surface after around 10 days if they're not weighted down by something, and nothing was missing from the boat that could have been used as a weight. Nothing had fallen in and dragged them in with it. Nothing appeared to be at all disturbed on their raft. It was all in order. Speculation rose that perhaps one of them had fallen in, the other had dived in to try to save them. But if that's the case, where are the bodies? Well, between the point where the raft and the journal were found, the last place that was spotted on their raft was a notorious rapid. In fact, it's known to be the most dangerous part of the trip. Mile 232 is known as being to be called the Fangs because of a set of very sharp rocks that lay in low-level water and had in the past snagged many rafts. Now, neither of the couple had the life preservers. Though they were available, they opted not to take them. That would add to the thrill of the adventure, they thought. It's agreed they could easily have gotten into trouble at this point if the boat had hit the upright Fangs, but the boat, when it was found, showed no signs whatsoever of any collision of any type. Didn't seem that it could have been the rocks that had caused her disappearance. If the boat was not damaged and her body's not found in the water, then they must have successfully cleared that part of the river. Well, many years later, while on a group rafting trip, an elderly lady confided to the group that she was in fact the missing Bessie. And she told a tale of having stabbed her brute of a husband, faked her own death, and made her escape to live under a false name. Problem was, when you looked into her background, she couldn't possibly have been Bessie. We're going to talk more about this tomorrow night, but for now, we've run out of time. So until tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Mountain, this is Ken Hudnall for The Ken Hudnall Show saying, have a truly great evening.